during the whole course of your training, you are lying on the couch and have your personal analysis. And beforehand, you don't know where it will lead you. You start to discover corners of your unconscious psyche, which you don't want, but you are not so eager to explore. So, and this accompanies you during the whole course of training, always confronted with your own psyche and with not yet discovered areas of your internal world. And this is really an adventurous journey. And the same you do with your patients. It's not that you treat a disease with certain symptoms, but you delve deeply into their souls. And this is a shared enterprise. Doing psychoanalysis, you are confronted with your own psyche. You are confronted with the psyche of the patient and, of course, of the patient too. And this confronts you with surprises, sometimes with deep anxieties, with terrors, and you never know beforehand. So I think the comparison of psychoanalytic training, of starting a journey with a sailing ship into the vast areas of the oceans, I think it's a good example. You never know exactly what will be the next day, what will you be confronted with.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. We've been talking to elders in our field, people who've been practicing for 50 plus years, and they share with us how they view this field evolving and where they see it going. We also talk to clinicians who had professions prior to becoming psychoanalysts, and they share with us their journeys to doing what they now love. These are just samplings of the psychoanalysts we've been talking with, again, from all corners of the globe. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Eike Hinze. Dr. Hinze is a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst in Berlin. And our conversation is about the challenges of psychoanalytic training. We characterize it as an adventurous immersion in the field, and we discuss from each of our points of view what we mean by an adventure and immersion. We consider how, when it goes well, an awareness and attunement to the inner experience of both oneself and of another counts as one of the profound pleasures in life. We discuss didactic training and how that can influence listening, and how the core competencies can sort of clear away some of the theoretical obstructions and allow one to be attuned to the experience happening in the office. We consider whether different types of patients need different types of interventions and how that might play a role in the challenges of psychoanalytic training. We consider neutrality, the value, and of course, impossibility of free association. And Icke emphasizes the unfortunate conflation of abstinence and unfriendliness, which of course are two entirely different phenomena. And we close with his sharing his journey and a bit of my own. His journey began in mathematics and then went to medicine and then went into psychoanalysis. Icke is, as I mentioned, a psychoanalyst in Berlin. He did his psychoanalytic training at the Berlin Karl Abraham Institute, and he currently works in his private practice, and he's the chair of training at the Institute. One of his main areas of interest is the psychoanalytic treatment of elderly patients. For 15 years, he's been working on the board of the Psychoanalytic Institute for Eastern Europe, the objective of which was to encourage the development and furthering of psychoanalysis in Eastern Europe. And he's the co-author of a recently published book studying commonalities and differences between different styles of performing psychoanalysis. He brings a down-to-earth warmth and thoughtfulness to this work, and I was grateful for the opportunity to get to know him, and I suspect you will be as well. Here's my conversation with Dr. Icke Hinze. Icke, welcome to the podcast. So good to have you.
Yeah, welcome, Harvey.
One of the pleasures we have, privileges even, of being a psychoanalyst is we get to observe and contribute to the development of student psychoanalysts. Whether one is a classroom teacher or a faculty advisor or supervisor, we can see in them over time the fine-tuning of their capacity to listen. To listen to the inner experience of themselves, and to listen to the inner experience of an other. And indeed, it's one of life's riches. Now, we've come up with the terms immersive and adventure to describe analytic training. I've contributed immersive, and you've contributed adventure, and we're going to each be responsible for each of our terms in just a moment. But I want to make clear to the listener that we are not naive, and that we are aware that analytic training is more than just an adventurous immersion. It is also at times difficult and time-consuming and expensive and challenging. It's all those things. But when the training goes well, these all can be put in service of a deeper appreciation of the human experience, which is, needless to say, no small matter. So to speak about immersion, my term, why did I put that forward? Well, on the manifest level, of course, analytic training is immersive. One has one's own analysis, one's clinical work with analysands. We have classroom work, we have supervision, we have activities and relationships with colleagues, students, hopefully with the institute that is supportive. All those things are part of the immersion. But the deeper aspect of immersion is common in many areas of life, whether it be the arts, whether it be athletics or research or science or medicine or parenting. All these are immersive activities. You give your heart and soul to it. And in fact, speaking for myself, anyone that I would want and allow to take care of me in any way, I would want them to have had an immersive experience in whatever endeavor it was. I would not only want them to have had it, but I would want them to want to have had it. That is, that whatever the activity is, that they've done it with their heart and soul, and that they can be depended upon to bring that heart and soul to the caretaking experience. And all of that is what I mean by immersion in psychoanalytic training. Icke, you want to take us on an adventure?
Yeah, I think I start with comparing psychoanalytic training with my medical training I had. I trained in neurology. I also trained in surgery and anesthetics. And of course, these are adventurous activities. But psychoanalytic training is in a way different. And mainly because during the whole course of your training, you are lying on the couch and have your personal analysis. And beforehand, you don't know where it will lead you. You start to discover corners of your unconscious psyche which you don't want, but you are not so eager to explore. So, and this accompanies you during the whole course of training, always confronted with your own psyche and with not yet discovered areas of your internal world. And this is really is an adventurous journey. And the same you do with your patients. It's not that you treat a disease with certain symptoms, but you delve deeply into their souls. And this is a shared enterprise. Doing psychoanalysis, you are confronted with your own psyche. You are confronted with the psyche of the patient and, of course, of the patient too. And this confronts you with surprises, sometimes with deep anxieties, with terrors, and you never know beforehand. So I think the comparison of psychoanalytic training, of starting a journey with a sailing ship into the vast areas of the oceans, I think it's a good example. You never know exactly what will be the next day, what will you be confronted with.
That's beautifully put. There are challenges in analytic training, as you just beautifully described, but there's also challenges in the form of training and the nature of training. And you've written about that in great detail in a paper that is in the recommended readings, and it's called What Do We Learn in Psychoanalytic Training? And I want to read parts of the paper and listen to your thoughts about it. You write, referring to the plurality of contemporary psychoanalysis, which we know is a common challenge in our field. You write, how does this plurality affect the training of future psychoanalysts? Do differing theoretical orientations of training institutes lead to or create an even greater diversity in conceptual and clinical approaches among young analysts? Do training analysts in different societies emphasize different abilities to describe and evaluate the development of their candidates? Do training analysts differ in what they consider as essential for a candidate to learn and develop during his or her training? You want to start us off with that?
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the differences and also the conceptual differences that they are. And sometimes one may have the impression that it is not pluralism, but it's chaotic, with all these very diverging theories and concepts. But the question is, are there commonalities? Are there core abilities? Every analyst, whatever theoretical orientation he has to share. And I think there are. And especially, you're always meeting your patient in a session. That's the normal situation every medical doctor has when he meets his patient. But this is different. Here, you are at stake with your whole personality and the patient too. And what's then happening in a psychoanalytic session? Again, it's adventurous. You never know it beforehand. And it's delving into the unconscious area of the patient, into your own too. Let me recite some very minor examples. There was a patient coming into the session, and then he told his analyst, oh, look, I forgot my dog in the car. And now, and the analyst said, okay, then get the dog. Bring it into the consulting room. And they left it like that. I think this would, a normal medical doctor would have done the same. But here was the question, is there an unconscious meaning? And it was. The dog represented the patient, the infantile self of the patient, abandoned, feeling alone, feeling suffering, devoid of essential nurturing items. And in this session, the analyst was not able, it was a candidate not able to grasp it and to understand the deeper meaning. So they talked about the dog, but they didn't really understand that the patient tried to convey a very deep layer of his soul where he constantly felt desperate and abandoned in all his relationships. And I have another example of my own practice. The toilet flushing was not functioning well and it didn't stop. And so the patient told, oh, what is it? And I said, oh, this is the toilet flush doesn't work. But later on in supervision, I recognized the patient wanted to convey to me a very deep-seated anxiety of what might happen in the analysis. I didn't grasp it. I think these are two examples of this special task an analyst is confronted with. But I think we come to it later on when we talk about free association and yes, even the suspended attention.
You've listed in your paper, despite this plurality of concepts, four core competencies. You call them recognizing the emotional demands of the patient, which you're were in that direction, free association, neutrality, and transfer, not the transfer. Do you have a sense, I mean, you just mentioned examples in supervision and presumably in one's own analysis, the candidate would consider the meanings both understood and not quite grasped of those two experiences where their own inner experience was represented through displacement. Do you have a sense of how we're jumping into classroom work, but it's part of a controversy now, certainly in the States, I suspect elsewhere. How do you teach this? Again, we understand that the essence of it, the emotional experience, but there's also classroom work. And the arguments, such as they are, do you start with Freud and do you spend a lot of time on Freud, or do you start with reverie, for example, which is a very popular concept here in the States? Do you have thoughts about that?
I have. Let me say, in my institute in Berlin, we have not a very rigidly structured training, but I think Freud is a basis. But at the same time, when we in the seminars start reading Freud, we read other modern authors too, but always accompanied by reading Freud. It's not an orthodox medieval learning the right authors, but I think never forget Freud. But of course, at the same time, reading modern authors and trying to compare and to see the developments, because there are developments. Psychoanalysis nowadays is not the same as it used to be at Freud's time.
That sounds like a quite reasonable blending of the old and the new.
Yeah.
Let me read another piece from your paper. You write, a decisive criterion for the developing analytic competence of a candidate is if he or she is able to grasp the emotional importance of the analytic encounter in the session and not only listens to interesting stories the patient is telling about his or her internal or external life. Although there is general agreement, this basic assumption leaves space for divergent points of view. Not all analysts, for example, share Tuckett's conviction that everything in the session is originating there. But you write, when I supervise psychoanalytic candidate colleagues of the German Psychoanalytic Society who are on their way to join the IPA, it was very often a striking experience for me when they started to really understand the impact of this analytic encounter. They themselves often saw it as a breakthrough in their analytic development. And that builds on the two examples you gave, where at a certain point, often from their own experience, one develops a sense, and I think we all can recall it from our own both personal analyses and treatment of others, where the experience with the analyst is so formative for so much that is going on in our life that we thought was entirely unrelated. Why don't you tell us your experience of this paragraph?
It's interesting. I made the same experience with colleagues from the society who wanted to enter the IPA when there was a point when they started, wow, this is real psychoanalysis. It became an adventure. And I think there is no very simple way. I think we still are based on the so-called Eidegon model, this three columns. You have your personal analysis accompanying the whole training. Then you have the theoretical seminars with a discussion with your peers, peer candidates, and experienced analysts. And I think this is very valuable, although it's theory. And then you have your own analytic cases you treat, and you let them supervise in a very high frequency. So normally the cases you treat are patients who come four times a week, and you have at least one supervision per week. And this, again, is a very deep and close personal experience between the candidate and the supervisor, both ways, for both of them.
Yes, and part of the challenge of the learning and those dyads is how individual it is. You write in that paper, contemporary analysts vary considerably in handling the transference according to their different conceptions of it. One axis of variation is the degree to which they get involved in reacting to the transference. They may interpret it from a position of a more neutral or even holding observer, or they may regard themselves involved in an action dialogue of transference, counter-transference, where the degree of their active involvement varies according to their conceptual background. These variations do not simply follow the usual scheme of different psychoanalytic schools. The inter-individual variation among psychoanalysts of the same so-called school orientation is considerable. Let me read that last sentence again, because I think it's key. The inter-individual variation among psychoanalysts of the same so-called school orientation is considerable. So what do you think about that?
Yeah. I think in a working party, I took part over almost two decades. It was a very encouraging experience to see that it was not so decisive whether an analyst belonged to one of these so-called schools, but that the essential variations were more individual or inter-individual. So that the influence of these so-called schools is not as decisive and important as I thought before. But there are differences how analysts conduct analysis, and it's not so easy to say this is better than the other. For example, just listening to the material of a patient and seeing what he tells about his life, his psyche, about his actual conflicts, and you being a rather neutral observer may function very well. There are these other types who feel they are often sucked in this dialect, like in an immersive theater, and that they enact also. The question is what do I emphasize in talking to the patient? Do I recognize that I'm a very active participant with my unconscious too, but don't talk about it with the patient and just restrict myself to what is the patient telling me, what's happening outside in his life, in his family, in his business, and then starting to understand it. And there are the others who are more concentrated on what's happening in the session. So there is an example. A patient comes to an analyst and talks about conflicts. he has with his boss at work and with his wife at home. And both analyst and patient try to understand better. And after a while, it became clear to the analyst that the patient was provoking. He was provoking, for example, his wife into being furious, into misbehaving, and then he could be very satisfied that he is not guilty. She is the one, or his boss, who always starts struggles and difficulties. And this helped the patient a lot. The vignette in this paper stopped at this point. The question is, oh, what was going on between the patient and the analyst? This was not analyzed further. And the question was the patient sometimes provoking the analyst into getting very active, perhaps sometimes a bit angry, and indoctrinating the patient? They didn't pay so much attention to it. And it can be okay. It may help the patient. It's not necessary to observe and take into account every aspect of the analytic dialogue. And there are indeed many dialogues. So, for example, I remember a French psychoanalyst. He talked to a patient and never mentioned that this patient was a drug addict. No mentioning of heroin, of drugs, just what's going on in the session. And apparently it helped the patient. And the difficulty is, how can analysts of these different orientations talk to each other? I think this is still, a possible development. We should one day reach that we can talk better about the different styles and then perhaps better define what is analysis and what is not analysis.
On an optimistic note, continuing your thinking, I for some time participated in a group where we analysts from all different theoretical orientations listened to process material. Mm-hmm. And what we all observed was that despite the different theoretical orientations, when we listened to the analysts' interventions, we all were in general agreement about whether it would be helpful or not helpful for the patient, whether it deepened the treatment. And in fact, if we share notions of a deepening experience, then often the theories fall away as a priority, that we are listening, what is the reaction of the patient to this intervention? Did it deepen their experience of themselves, of their immersion in the moment and their relationship with the analyst, with all that that carries with it? And I think it is helpful to emphasize the skill of listening to what patients do with our interventions, not whether they meet any theoretical criteria for being the right one to make, but just to see, let's see what the patient does with it. And by that, of course, I don't mean if they say yes or no, that was a good comment or not a good comment, but how it impacts the flow of associations, both in that session and down the road as well. But there's another challenge, I think, that you are alluding to indirectly. You're talking about analysts who either immerse themselves in the action of the transference or analysts who observe the transference. And that is the difficulty in learning this work in treating different types of patients. I remember some years ago, a recently graduated candidate contacted me and asked for a consultation for some patient they were treating. And what he said was that, you know, I think this patient has a neurotic problem, and in my training, I only treated more disturbed patients, so I'm not sure what to do. And, I mean, we could take that exchange in many directions, but the importance of recognizing that there are different skill sets, not just from the theory of the analyst, but involved in making emotional contact with the patient, neurotic patients, as you've been describing, suffer from conflicts that are more or less observable to them with analytic interventions. Well, there are some patients we know who their minds don't work that way, usually from earlier trauma. They experience themselves through the imagined eyes of the other, and that's all they know about their inner experience. They project onto the other, in this case, the analyst, and they think that's who they are. And that involves a very different skill set, a very different type of tolerance for countertransference, a different type of being present with them. And those are patients perhaps more often will seek out analytic training, especially low fee cases with candidates. But what's your thought about that?
I think you address a very important topic. And perhaps I'm a little bit in dissonance with you. There are very different types of patients with very different types of psychopathology. In this case, with your candidate, I would ask, what do you mean by neurotic? What do you mean? What is neurotic in your system? And then very often start very interesting discussions because these terms are used and often not very clearly defined. I think there is a basic attitude of an analyst. It's a little bit of a more passive trying to understand. I think the wish to understand what's going on, how can I understand the patient, how can I understand his actual life, the interaction in the session, this is the main objective. And of course, one has to deal with different patients in different ways. And there are analysts, I think, who can better cope with severely early disturbed patients. And there are analysts who can better perform with more mature patients. That's very clear. But the problem is, are there really very different skills, or is it sometimes very seductive to be, for example, more active and then think, okay, this is helping the patient? Sometimes I'm a bit more skeptical, and our terminology, I think, it's a difficulty in psychoanalysis. Many terms we have used their distinctive potency. Like, is it a neurotic patient or is it an early disturbed patients, because if you look, have a narrow look at a patient, then you always discover something happened in their early childhood.
Yeah.
So I think my position is, be cautious before knowing so much of a patient, what is his disturbance. Sometimes we need years to really discover what's the real problem. And it always depends on the specific case. For example, I remember a middle-aged woman who, of course, always brought her dog with her. So we were three in the room.
Right,
I had to handle it and have to protect my carpet for the attacks of the dog. Was very interesting. And this patient didn't have any difficulty to breastfeed her baby just in front of me. So it was a very different situation, but the main aim, how can I understand it? I think this stayed the same, although my handling the situation was more, I think it was more active than usual.
I think this easily segues into the concept of neutrality, which you've written about, which is part of free association. You write, free association and evenly suspended attention can only flourish in the presence of an analytic attitude of neutrality. Neutrality here is understood as an equal distance of the analyst to the patients and his own superego, ego, and id. The necessity of a neutral analytic attitude was not always explicitly stressed, but usually it was implicitly assumed as a necessary prerequisite for psychoanalytic work. You know, it's funny. I've read this many times, and each time I read it, I sort of pause when I read superego, ego, and id. I haven't seen that written in the literature in a very long time. And I was, and that may be, you know, the European German literature as contrasted to the American, I'm not sure, but it was sort of brought up my earlier years. Mm-hmm. Neutrality is really the key. And again, the distinction, neutrality and abstinence are not the same thing. Neutrality is a state of mind. And you're saying no matter what the patient and no matter what the theory, one always has to be neutral and curious. And having that be apart from one's own prejudices or to the best of one's ability, to the one's own stereotypes, but to be actually curious about the inner life of the other. Can you share with us a little bit more about neutrality?
Yeah, it's a central term. And I think one difficulty, it is often really confused with abstinence. And Yes. You're right, these are different terms. And sometimes abstinence is equated with unfriendliness. And perhaps there are former generations where analysts used to be rather unfriendly. And this was defined as abstinence, but one can be very friendly and personal and nevertheless be abstinent. Neutrality, and an interesting experience with a Swiss colleague some weeks ago, he said, okay, he transformed this definition in something slightly different. He said, not the same distance from ego, id, and superego, but the same closeness, not so much expressing it in a negative way. I had to keep apart from the it, keep apart from the superego and the ego, but coming close to it, but in the same way, not favoring one above the other. And I think it sounds very theoretical, but I think it's very practical advice. The temptation to become too close to the superego, I think, is always present. I, as an analyst, knowing better, and then saying to the patient, you are not right, I'm the analyst, I know better. Then I am a personified superego problem. Or I'm siding with the id and talking like with a dog, talking about how to handle a dog, not leaving a dog in the car, or repairing my toilet flush. And not seeing, oh, what's underneath it. And of course, siding with the id, these are all the boundary violations we know. And so I think it's a very practical definition, but it's not unfriendliness, not abstinence, but is the attempt. And you never reach it. You never. But thinking about it between the sessions is very useful. But adhering rigidly to such a structure, I think this makes then the analysis a lifeless encounter. Yeah. Impossible.
It's like free association. We never reach it. It's always a lifelong process. Yeah.
But that's, I think, it's the adventure in psychoanalysis. As a physical doctor, I follow certain rules. Everybody knows it, and I can follow them. But in analysis, you're dealing with the psyche, and this is a muddy underground. You never are really sure. You always guess and think, and then guess again, and never have the certitude, now I know everything about this patient. Never.
You make the important point about confusing abstinence with unfriendliness. I think one of the hardest things to learn as a student analyst is that when you are being asocial with someone, when you're not exchanging a conversation as if you were friends or acquaintances, that it is experienced, very understandably, as a deprivation, that you are depriving the patient of something they want. They want to be friendly. And so why can't you answer the question about how many children you have or where you went on vacation, et cetera? And you talk about turning points in education and development. I think it's when you really have a sense that by doing something asocial, you are intending to give the patient a gift that isn't apparent to them, but is to you. And it's a gift that if you don't engage in the social way, and you maintain this asocial relationship, that will provide for them an opportunity to learn something unique and valuable about their inner life. And if you see yourself as giving them something while ostensibly depriving them, but maintain that conviction, hopefully from one's own experience as Anna Lassand, then you don't feel guilty. Then you're not trying to be extra nice, not worrying about what your supervisor will say, all that kind of thing. But you really are committed to giving them a gift. I think when you reach that, you can be even friendlier to patients while knowing what the structures are. That's just what occurred to me.
I think you're absolutely right. And it's not easy to learn it. And I think there are different styles. For example, there are cases when I mentioned my kids, but I thought about it and before and afterwards. And I wondered, was it okay? Why did I do it? Always, it's always a very dynamic equilibrium. One example, I think it occurred when I was a very young analyst. A young woman in analysis brought me a rose, one rose. Mm-hmm. And what to do with presents patients give to you. Yeah. So I thought, well, the young analyst, okay, I accept it. I'm not an unfriendly analyst. Take it in a neutral way. I put it in a vase.
Whatever that means. Wait a second. Take it in a neutral way. Tell me what that means.
But that's exactly what the problem, because the next days and weeks, the patient reacted very, very furious because I did not really see and experience what this rose was meant for. It was an expression of her love, of a very passionate love. Uh-huh. And I took it as a flower, putting it into a vase. And that's what I did not understand. And perhaps because I was afraid of this passionate love of this patient. And so I was neutral in a bad sense,
right,
and did not really understand her out of my countertransference or perhaps out of my transference onto the patient.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, forgive me for putting you on the spot, but if you were to do it again, knowing all that you know, how would you deal with that gift?
I would do the same, not letting the flower dry, and I would accept it. But I would be more concentrated, not on the real flower, on the egg, but what does it mean? Why now? Mm-hmm. What do I feel receiving the flower? And I was so busy at that time with how shall I act? What's the real way to, say to act? I would try to understand, follow my own thread of thoughts. I omitted it in this session, but I think out of my counter transference.
Did you leave the flower in the office for its longevity till it died?
That's an interesting question. I didn't keep it in my consulting room, but there, I think there you are on the center of what's going on between patient and analyst. So what shall I do? I had a very old lady who used sometimes brought me a cake. And one day I developed a fantasy, is this cake perhaps poisoned? I knew it was not. But this fantasy helped me a lot to understand the patient and her paranoid background of her childhood experiences. But I ate the cake at home. Right. I know colleagues who would say, oh, that's impossible. That's not neutral. But it was a very delicious cake. So you are always in a dynamic balance how to cope with the emotional demands of the patient.
You know, it's an interesting story. Some time ago, a patient who knew I enjoyed cigars traveled out of the country and brought me back a box of cigars. Now, yeah. This was a man who was very limited in his capacity to identify his affects and certainly identify his affections. And it was up to that point, the warmest thing he had ever done in recognizing my existence in his life. And I was sharing this story with colleagues. And just as you say, people were bothered. They asked me, what did you do with the cigars? Mm-hmm. I said, I smoked them. And yeah. they were really troubled by that. And I was troubled that they were troubled. I mean, you know, one likes to have one's work shared and appreciated by colleagues. And I couldn't quite wrap my head around, why would I not accept the gift, keeping in mind that it's multi-determined, that there are all kinds of meanings in this. But where we're starting at this point is, this is the best he is able to do at this moment in time to bring himself and me together in the room. And there's more to be said about this. It's a problem in the field. It may be changing, and it may be changing at times too much in the other direction, where one just accepts things and doesn't consider the multiple meanings, including the ambivalences contained in them. And maybe like free association, neutrality, it's always imperfect, that we will always err on listening to one side or another. But hopefully the ball is moving. I want to read the closing paragraph from your paper, mm-hmm. and then I want to ask you about you.
May I just add one remark with the cigars? I think it would be then very interesting, what do I feel smoking the cigars? And I think this may give very valuable clues to understand the patient, because my fantasies, is this cake poisoned, was a very valuable clue which I could bring back to the patient. When I had not eaten it, then I wouldn't have had the thought.
There you go. Yes. You write, understanding the emotional demand of a patient and the ensuing emotional storm, appreciating and deeply understanding the value of free association, preserving a neutral stance, thinking in terms of transference and countertransference, and being able to conceptually think about what is happening and what one is doing in the session. That's how you conclude this paper. And you just said the same thing about the cigar exchange. That's what one's task is for the goodness and well-being of the patient. Before we go, you have had a fascinating journey, being in medicine, being in surgery, being a psychoanalyst. Tell us a bit about it.
Yeah, I started in a rather unusual way. I started studying mathematics and theoretical physics. I was so fascinated by science and just to discover the secrets of the world. So I studied it for almost 2 years, and I still love it. But then one day I thought, if you continue this path, then you keep away from your fellow human beings. It's you too solitary. And what will be your development? If you do it for a decade, then perhaps you become a very, very strange human being, a bit autistic. So I said, no, I have to do something else. And so in discussions with friends, I changed to medicine, having more contact with people. And then this study was fascinating. But first, the physical side. I found it fascinating later on to study neurology. I liked it very much to work on a surgical department. But the more I gained experience after my graduation, I saw that even seemingly purely physical symptoms were very often at least co-determined by the psychical factors. And this, I saw it more and more and more, and started to read Freud, started to work on the psychosomatic department, working in psychiatry. And then slowly I turned myself into the direction of the psyche and started psychoanalytic training. I know. Sometimes I'm longing a bit back, and this is a weak point. If a patient comes with a medical problem, then mm-hmm. sometimes I'm inclined to enact and give a medical advice.
Yeah,
this is a weak point.
Yeah. Well, but my imagining is that while you may give the medical advice, you're also attuned to the meaning to that patient of your having given the medical advice.
I try.
Right. You know, it's funny, you mentioned the physical and the emotional in medicine. It brought up a memory that I haven't had in a while. When I was active in psychiatric training in the university medical center, we would bring medical students, a group of medical students, and to the ward, to the medical floors, and randomly select a patient. And I would interview the patient to teach the students about what psychiatrists have to offer in such interviews. And I was randomly assigned a patient with sickle cell anemia, life-threatening condition. And he had been hospitalized over the prior year and a half multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him really very naively, I knew nothing about the patient. I said, well, had anything happened to you that led to this increased number of hospitalizations? And he said, quite matter-of-factly, yes, my wife died. I said, oh. And he then recounted with no affects, I assume the affects were tied up in the physical symptoms, that he's gotten depressed and he's gotten withdrawn, but he had no feeling about it. He just described the behaviors. He was staying at home. He was withdrawn from people. And when I asked him how he felt about this, he indicated no feeling at all. And it was a remarkable event for me and certainly the students to see how the unawareness of affects can lead to such powerful, life-threatening, and also very expensive to treat medical problems. I mean, this man was hospitalized multiple times, costing a great deal of money. I mention that only because people talk about how expensive analysis is. Well, not compared to its alternative, often. That's something we can do more teaching of. When you and I spoke in anticipation of our conversation today, and I said, would you be comfortable sharing your journey? And you said, yes, how about yours? And I said, sure, I think fair is fair. If I'm going to ask you a bit about yours, I should share a bit about mine. And the version, I'll leave the childhood material out, but I remember I was in college and I was trying to figure out what my major would be. And I was sitting in a general psychology class reading the textbook. And there was this paragraph with a picture of somebody reaching for something in the top of a closet. And the point of this picture and the writing around it was, depending upon the way one thinks about what they're going to find will change their experience of what they're about to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all of a sudden, like we're talking about lights going off in our mind, a light went off on me. I said, wait a second. So it's not the thing itself. It's how your mind pictures it and anticipates it that governs this behavior. And I was just, it was one of those moments, and I said, I'm going to be a psychology major. Jumping ahead, I was in medical school, and I was in my school. You had to choose an area of specialty in your fourth year of medical school, and I chose pediatrics. Long story that isn't relevant at the moment, but I noticed that I was sneaking out of the pediatric lectures to go to the psychiatry lectures, and that, in a bunch of personal matters, all of a sudden, I was in analysis at the time, and I came into my analysis, and I lie down on the couch, and I announced. I said, I'm going into psychiatry. And I hear from behind me my analyst laughing. He was a sweet old man, and he had this very warm, hearty laugh. I said, why are you laughing? And he said, you're the last to know. And it stays in my mind. And it's an example of everything we've been talking about, that there are parts of our mind that aren't obvious to us. And over the course of a deepening treatment, we become aware of parts of ourselves that reveal not only our experience in the office, but our life outside the office. And that is, I began by saying, it's one of the riches of life. And listening to you and speaking with you really gives a real feel about your immersion in this, certainly, the adventure that you allow yourself and invite the patient to share. And I want to thank you, Aiki. It's been a real pleasure, both reading your paper, speaking with you, and feeling your adventurousness. It's really been terrific.
And I thank you, Harvey, for this so interesting, warm, and rich conversation.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.